the plan to establish trading posts in their neighborhood. Through Heaney, Lewis was trying to talk to the Sioux and the British. He told Heaney that the Corps of Discovery had gone to the Pacific Ocean by way of the Missouri and Columbia Rivers, and that he was about to explore the Marias. He obviously hoped that Heaney would pass this information on to his superiors in the company, who would inform government officials in Montreal, who would thus learn of Lewis's explorations and the potential American claim on the Oregon country, and possibly on southern Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. Lewis said he hoped to arrive at the Mandan villages about the beginning of September. Heaney should meet him there with a party not to exceed 12 persons, the largest that the expedition could accommodate. A good idea. If it worked, Sioux chiefs would go to Washington, they would be mightily impressed, they would come home and make peace, renounce their British loyalties, welcome American trading posts on the Missouri, and become full-fledged partners in the grand enterprise of building the American Empire. If it worked, and if Lewis found a Blackfoot band and spread the good news of the coming of the Americans and persuaded the Blackfeet to join the enterprise, within a couple of years the Americans would take over the fur trade from the Mississippi to the mouth of the Columbia. That was a big dream, an empire builder's dream. Lewis was thinking on a worldwide scale. He was proposing to set up and execute one of the biggest business takeover deals of the century and add the Northwestern Empire to the United States in the bargain. Sitting beside Lolo Creek, near the place where it flows into the Bitterroot River, in a wide, beautiful, extensive valley, at least 1,000 miles from the nearest white outpost, in command of a platoon-sized force in a country teeming with war parties, utterly destitute of equipment, except for rifles and kettles and a few remaining knives, exactly the manufactured items the Indians most wanted, Meriwether Lewis got started on making his dream come true in his letter to Heaney. What a many-faceted man was Lewis. On the day he put the final touches to the plan for separate explorations, informed the men of what he and Clark intended, picked the volunteers to accompany him, and wrote that long letter to Heaney, he also found time to do a bird count and write a 500-word essay on the prairie dog. The next day, July 2nd, he spent much of his time in conversation with the Indians, using sign language, trying to get a better fix on the lay of the land ahead. In the evening, "The Indians run their horses, and we had several foot races between the natives and our party with various success." He concluded with a handsome tribute to the 5 young Indians who had guided him over the Lolo Trail and thus saved the expedition. "These are a race of hardy, strong, athletic, active men." Chapter 29. The Marias Exploration. July 3rd to July 28th, 1806. On the morning of July 3rd, Lewis wrote, "I took leave of my worthy friend and companion Captain Clark and the party that accompanied him." As the captains and men shook hands and said their goodbyes, there must have been a question in every man's mind. "I wonder if I'll ever see you again." The proposed rendezvous at the Missouri-Yellowstone Junction was a full 500 miles east of Traveler's Rest, as the crow flies. Clark's proposed route would cover nearly 1,000 miles, Lewis's nearly 800. Both captains would be in country they had not seen before, facing they knew not what dangers from the weather, the terrain, and the natives. Except for their rifles, scientific instruments, and journals, the men were no better equipped than the Indians, and none of the 5 detachments of the Corps of Discovery would have enough firepower to drive off a determined attack from even a moderate-sized war party. But such confident travelers had the captains become that what they said to each other as they parted was, "See you at the junction in 5 or 6 weeks." Whether their confidence in themselves and their men had swelled past all reason was theirs to discover. That Lewis felt at least a tinge of apprehension is clear from his comment on the parting. "I could not avoid feeling much concern on this occasion, although I hoped this separation was only momentary." Lewis, 9 men, 5 Nez Perce guides, and 17 horses set out northward down the Bitterroot River. At 10 miles they crossed the river by raft and continued their march eastward along today's Clark Fork River to within a couple of miles of today's Missoula, Montana. At sunset they made camp. Hunters brought in 3 deer, which Lewis split with the Indians. He tried to persuade them to stay with his party until they got over the Continental Divide and down to the falls of the Missouri, but they said he didn't need them. The road was such a well-beaten track, even a white man couldn't miss the way. Besides, they were afraid of meeting with a Hidatsa raiding party. Just before lying down on his elk skin, Lewis ordered the hunters to turn out early in the morning to kill some meat for the guides, whom I was unwilling to leave without giving them a good supply of provisions, after their having been so obliging as to conduct us through those tremendous mountains. They parted at noon the following day, July 4th. Independence Day drew no comment from Lewis, no mention of the men firing their rifles. If anything, it was a sad day, the last contact with the Nez Perce, among whom the party had been living for 2 months. The Nez Perce had seen the white soldiers hungry and fed them, seen them cold and provided fuel, seen them without horses and put them on mounts, seen them confused and provided good advice, seen them make fools of themselves trying to cross mountains 10 feet deep in snow and not snickered, seen them lost and guided them. They had ridden together, eaten together, slept together, played together, and crossed the Lolo Trail together. Although they could communicate only with the sign language, they had an abundance of shared experiences that drew them together. They had managed to cross communication and cultural barriers to become genuine friends. These affectionate people, our guides, betrayed every emotion of unfeigned regret at separating from us, Lewis wrote. The Nez Perce could not hide their anxiety about their new friends. They said that they were confident that the Pakis, the term probably means enemies, not a specific tribe, would cut us off. As the Indians set off to the north, Lewis and his men headed east. They passed through present-day Missoula, up today's Broadway Street, across the river from the University of Montana. At 5 miles, they came to today's Blackfoot River, called River of the Road to Buffalo by the Nez Perce, coming in from the east and headed up it, through a heavily timbered country of high and rocky mountains. The next day, they made 31 miles. The place they camped that night had been a Hidatsa war party camp a couple of months earlier. On July 6, the Indian sign included fresh tracks along the trail. Lewis was concerned. "They have a large passel of horses," he commented. He expected to meet with either the Hidatsas or another hunting party at any time, so he and the men were much on our guard both day and night. His luck held. There were no encounters with Indians, friendly or hostile. His trip up the Blackfoot River, through one of the most beautiful valleys in Montana, was happily uneventful. What caught Lewis's eye was much sign of beaver in this extensive bottom. On July 7th, the party turned in a more northerly direction to follow the Nez Perce Trail up today's Alice Creek. There were many beaver dams, many deer. Reuben Field wounded a moose. "My dog much worried," Lewis wrote, without giving any detail but apparently referring to the wounded moose. At about 11 miles, the creek was not much more than a trickle, coming from a spring on the side of a low, untimbered mountain. The trail wound up the north side of the creek, then switched back a couple of times before disappearing over the top of the pass. The trail is plainly evident today, including travois marks from the thousands of Nez Perce who used it. It can be reached by driving up Alice Creek Road off Montana Highway 200, some 10 miles east of Lincoln, Montana. The pass is called Lewis and Clark Pass, 6,284 feet, somewhat misnamed since Clark never saw it. The party wound its way up the gentle slope. At the top, it reached the dividing ridge between the waters of the Columbia and Missouri rivers. To the east, Lewis could see Square Butte, near the falls of the Missouri, not far from where he stood. The great plains of North America stretched out in front of him, apparently without limit, under an infinity of bright blue sky. He took a step, and he was back in U.S. territory. The descent was easy through hills and hollows. The men could talk only of buffalo, but none were encountered, although tantalizing signs were all about them. The next day, the party crossed the Dearborn River and closed on the Medicine, today's Sun River, where they camped. On July 9th, Joseph Field killed a fat buffalo. "We halted to dine," Lewis wrote. Once they got some roasts going, it commenced to drizzle. That settled it. I concluded to remain all day, Lewis wrote, and added by way of explanation, we feasted on the buffalo. He and the men were much rejoiced at finding ourselves in the plains of the Missouri which abound with game. They surely did. On July 10th, the hunters killed 5 deer, 3 elk, and a bear. They saw herds of buffalo farther down the river. The bellowing of the bulls through the night, it was mating season, kept them awake. It was one continual roar, so loud it frightened the horses. There were vast assemblages of wolves, herds of elk. Lewis and his men had thought they knew how much they missed the plains, but found out they had underestimated. Fresh roasted buffalo hump and tongue tasted even better than they had remembered. Lewis was on his way home, with great discoveries made, and discoveries yet to be made. His stomach was full as it hadn't been since he had left the buffalo country the previous July. He was in a fine, mellow mood, as he showed in the morning when he began his journal with a charming tribute to the great plains of Montana. The morning was fair and the plains looked beautiful, the grass much improved by the late rain. The air was pleasant and a vast assemblage of little birds which crowded to the groves on the river sung most enchantingly. On the march that day, headed down the Sun River to the Missouri, the party went through a level, beautiful, and extensive high plain covered with immense herds of buffalo. I sincerely believe that there were not less than 10,000 buffalo within a circle of 2 miles. The buffalo provided not only meat, but also coverings for boats. Lewis had 11 of them shot and willow sticks collected to make bull boats, one in the Mandan fashion, the other, on a plan of our own, otherwise unexplained, for crossing the Missouri to the cache on the east bank. In the morning, terrible news. The men sent to round up the horses returned to report that 7 of the 17 were missing. Lewis immediately suspected a hunting party had stolen them. He sent Driard to search for them, although what he thought Driard could do if he caught up with the thieves he did not say. In fact, the order was a mistake, both because of Driard's obvious helplessness in the face of 20 or 30 mounted warriors, and because it deprived Lewis of his sole means of communication with other Indians should they be encountered. After Driard rode off, the horses swam across the river, the bull boats were paddled over, and camp was set up on the site they had occupied during the Great Portage of 1805. The cache was opened. High water during the spring runoff had gotten into it. Lewis's plant specimens were all lost, but fortunately the papers and maps were okay. The loss of the specimens was a terrible blow. They had been collected painstakingly, labeled, carefully dried, requiring daily attention, and preserved. Paul Russell Cutright writes, "Such losses were more than minor catastrophes, resulting as they did in the defeat of prime scientific objectives and the complete vitiation of weeks and months of dedicated effort and inquiry." That night, Lewis found that he had forgotten something else about life on the Missouri River. "Mosquitoes excessively troublesome," he wrote, "insomuch that without the protection of my mosquito beer, I should have found it impossible to write a moment." On July 14th, Lewis had the men prepare the baggage for the upcoming portage. He sent his trunks containing his papers and journals to one of the islands, to be put on a scaffold in a thick brush and covered with skins. "I take this precaution," he explained, "lest some Indians may visit the men I leave here before the arrival of the main party and rob them." In the aftermath of losing nearly half of his horses to a roving band of warriors, he was beginning to fear that perhaps he was dividing the Corps of Discovery in too many parts. But his fear was not so strong as to cause him to call off his exploration of the Marias, even though the loss of the horses meant he had to reduce the size of his party from 6 to 3 men. At least that would leave 6 men at the falls, perhaps enough for self-defense. Driard didn't come in that day, which worried Lewis. Nor did he return the following day. Lewis began to fear that a grizzly had killed him. He explained his reasoning. "I knew that if he met with a bear in the plains, even he would attack him, and that if any accident should happen to separate him from his horse in that situation, the chances in favor of his being killed would be as 9 to 10. At 1 o'clock p.m., July 15th, Driard returned. He reported that he had searched for 2 days before discovering where the thieves had run the stolen horses over the Dearborn River. He pursued their tracks, but they had a 2-day start, so he gave it up. He figured the strength of the party at 15 lodges. Lewis assumed it was a hunting party looking for buffalo. He had seen that day how much roving it took to find the herds. There was not a buffalo in sight where the previous day they covered the earth. Such huge herds had to keep moving to find grass, which meant that those who hunted them had to keep moving. Which meant that the Corps of Discovery had been exceedingly lucky the previous year to have avoided all contact with the natives until they got to the Shoshone village. With Driard returned, Lewis was ready to set out in the morning for the Marias exploration. He had selected Driard and the Field Brothers. He would take 6 horses, leaving 2 of the best and 2 of the worst with the party at the falls to assist in the portage. He closed his journal. "The mosquitoes continue to infest us in such manner that we can scarcely exist. My dog even howls with the torture he experiences. They are almost insupportable." On July 16th, the exploring party set out, stopping first at the falls where Lewis made a drawing. Then it was out of the river valley and up onto the high plains. To Lewis's eye, the plains have somewhat the appearance of an ocean, not a tree nor a shrub to be seen. He was back in Wonderland. "The whole face of the country, as far as the eye can reach, looks like a well-shaved bowling green, in which immense and numerous herds of buffalo were seen feeding, attended by their scarcely less numerous shepherds, the wolves." The enchantment of the place did not prevent Lewis from worrying. His expressed desire to meet the Blackfeet had given way to fear. When he was planning this exploration, he had hoped to have with him some leading Nez Perce men so that he could make a peace between the Nez Perce and the Blackfeet. That motive was now gone. Further, he had planned to explore with a party of 7. Now he was down to 4. Finally, what the Nez Perce said about the Blackfeet, "They are a vicious, lawless, and rather an abandoned set of wretches," had its effect on Lewis. His conclusion, "I wish to avoid an interview with them if possible." Because he had no doubt that, "Finding us weak should they happen to be numerous, the Blackfeet will most probably attempt to rob us of our arms and baggage." He vowed to take every possible precaution to avoid them if possible. The ride through Wonderland continued. On July 18th, we passed immense herds of buffalo. In short, for about 12 miles it appeared as one herd only, the whole plains being covered with them. Indians never left his mind. At camp that night, on the Marias River, he noted, "I keep a strict lookout every night. I take my tour of watch with the men." For 3 more days, Lewis followed the Marias upstream. On the afternoon of July 21st, the river forked into 2 branches, today's Cutbank Creek coming from the north, and 2 Medicine River flowing from the south. Since Lewis's whole purpose was to find the northernmost branch of the Marias, he did not hesitate to follow up Cutbank Creek. But because the Marias had been leading him on an almost straight westward route, he confessed that, "The most northern point, I now fear, will not be as far north as I wished and expected." On Tuesday, July 22nd, Lewis got to within 20 miles of the Rocky Mountains, in sight of the Continental Divide in today's Glacier National Park. About 20 miles northwest of the modern town of Cutbank, he set up camp in a beautiful and extensive bottom of the river, in a clump of large cottonwoods. From the bluff overhanging the bottom, Lewis could see where the creek came out of the mountains, and it was southwest, not northwest, of his position. He had reached the northernmost point of Cutbank Creek. He decided to stay there for a couple of days, to rest the men and horses and to make celestial observations. "I now have lost all hope of the waters of this river ever extending to north latitude 50 degrees," he admitted, but he was not one to give up easily. "I still hope and think it more than probable that both White Earth River and Milk River extend as far north as latitude 50 degrees. Arlen Large explains his methods and results. Lewis measured the sun's noon altitude on July 23rd, getting a raw octant reading of 62 degrees, 0 feet, 0 inches. He didn't record any conversion of that suspiciously round number into a latitude. Using an 1806 nautical almanac and Lewis's usual method of computation, that octant reading would have produced a latitude of 48 degrees, 10 feet, or some 30 feet too far south. I think it's very possible he didn't compute a latitude here because he wasn't carrying an 1806 almanac. My surmise is that the expedition's three almanacs covered 1803, 1804, and 1805 only. His conclusion that Cutbank Creek didn't reach as high as 50 degrees probably was based on dead reckoning. Using as a benchmark the previous year's calculation of 47 degrees, 25 feet, 17 inches, as the latitude of the Marias-Missouri Junction, he could have seen from his compass courses and distances on the way to Cutbank Creek that it was well short of the 170-odd miles needed to reach the 50th parallel. What Lewis needed to know was the time, and that he got from his equal altitudes of the sun. He set his chronometer at high noon. If he could make a sextant measurement of a daytime sun-moon distance, he could figure the time in Greenwich. Then he would know his longitude. The following day, Driard returned from a scouting mission to report that there was much sign of Indians in the area. Lewis's attempts to make his observations were frustrated by cloud cover, both that day and the next, and the next. The men went out to hunt without success, a sure sign Indians had been hunting in the area in considerable numbers. The men reported various signs of Indians, some of them large campsites with many, many horses. "We consider ourselves extremely fortunate in not having met with these people," Lewis wrote. He decided he would leave in the morning, July 26th, unless the sun came out so that he could make observations. He was apprehensive that I shall not reach the United States within this season unless I make every exertion in my power, which I shall certainly not omit. The morning of Saturday, July 26th, was cloudy. Lewis waited until 9 o'clock a.m. before giving up, which I do with much reluctance. He had the horses caught, and we set out bidding a lasting adieu to this place, which I now call Camp Disappointment. The party rode south toward Two Medicine River, which it struck around midday. After eating and grazing the horses, the party resumed its march, with Driard ahead in the river bottom, hunting. As the hills closed in on the south bank of the river, Lewis and the Field brothers ascended them to the high plain above, while Driard continued to ride down the valley. When Lewis got to the top and looked about, he was alarmed to see, at the distance of a mile or so, a herd of 30 horses. He brought out his telescope and discovered several Indians sitting their horses, staring intently into the valley. Lewis surmised they were watching Driard. "This was a very unpleasant sight," Lewis admitted. If there were as many Indians as there were horses, which he assumed would be the case, he was overwhelmingly outnumbered. He thought they were Atsinas or Blackfeet. In either case, from their known character, I expected that we were to have some difficulty with them. He thought of flight and immediately gave it up. To run was to invite pursuit, and the Indians' horses looked better than his. Further, if he and the Field brothers ran, Driard would most probably fall a sacrifice. Lewis resolved to make the best of our situation. He ordered Joseph Field to display the flag which Lewis had brought for just this purpose. When it was unfurled, the party advanced slowly on the Indians, who were running about in a very confused manner as if much alarmed. Suddenly, a single Indian broke out of the milling pack and whipped his horse full speed toward the party. He was probably on a dare trying to count coop. Lewis dismounted and stood, waiting for the onrushing horse and rider. The Indian was disarmed by Lewis's reaction. He halted some 100 yards from the party. Lewis held out his hand. The Indian wheeled his horse around, gave it the whip, and galloped back to his companions. Lewis could count them by now. There were 8 teenage boys and young men. He suspected there were others hidden behind the bluffs, for there were several other horses saddled. He ordered the Field brothers to advance with him slowly. His heart pounded. His life and the lives of his men were at stake. So were his papers, dearer to him even than his life. He told the Field brothers that no matter how many Indians there were, he was resolved to resist, to the last extremity, preferring death to being deprived of my papers, instruments, and gun. He hoped they would form the same resolution. When they nodded a grim-faced assent, Lewis told them to be alert and on their guard. James Rhonda writes that Lewis's words were filled with more swagger than wisdom. There is a bit of melodrama in this mutual pledge to fight to the last breath, and asking the Field brothers to swear was hardly necessary. It was not as if they had a lot of choice. If the Indians wanted to fight, there would be a fight. This was the pickle Lewis's leadership had brought them to. Four men alone, and one of them separated from the rest, in the heart of Blackfoot country, had run into a roving band of young Indian braves. Two parties of armed young men, each suspicious of the other, were attempting to occupy the same space at the same time. That always meant trouble. The Red War Party outnumbered the White War Party by at least 2-1, and possibly much more. The natives figured to have reinforcements close at hand. The whites had no reinforcements within 200 miles. It was Lewis's fault. He was the one who had dreamed up this exploration, the one who had decided to make it with a party of four only, the one who had delayed 2 full days at Camp Disappointment, even though he knew that every additional hour in Blackfoot country raised the risks of an unwelcome encounter and that Clark would soon be waiting for him at the Yellowstone, and even though he wanted to get back to St. Louis as soon as possible. But there were positive possibilities in the situation. If a friendly, or at least a non-violent, initial contact could be made, Lewis would have a chance to bring these Indians into the American trading empire. That would justify the risks he had taken. When he got to within 100 yards of the Indians, Lewis had the Field brothers stop while he advanced singly to meet an Indian who had ridden out ahead of his group. The two men met and cautiously shook hands. Then both passed on to shake hands with the others in their respective parties. Lewis dismounted. So did the Indians, who asked for pipes and smoke. Using his limited sign language skills, Lewis told them that the pipe was with his hunter, down below in the valley. He proposed that an Indian ride down with Reuben Field to find Driard and bring him back. This was done. Lewis asked who they were. He thought they replied that they were Atsinas, a tribe known to Lewis as the Minotaurs of the North. Actually, they were Piegans, members of one of the three main divisions of the Blackfeet. Lewis asked who was the chief. Three men stepped forward. Lewis thought they were too young and too many to be chiefs, but he also thought it best to please them. He handed out a medal, a flag, and a handkerchief. By now, Lewis had concluded that there were no more than 8 Blackfeet in the immediate area, and he was convinced that we could manage that number should they attempt any hostile measures. The late July sun was starting to sink in the west. Lewis proposed that they camp together. That was agreed to. On the way down the steep bluff, they picked up Driard, Field, and the Indian. They came to a delightful spot on a bend in the river, a bowl-shaped bottomland with 3 large cottonwoods in the center and excellent grass. The Blackfeet made a rough dome with willow branches, threw some dressed buffalo skins over it, and invited the whites to join them in the shelter. Driard and Lewis accepted. The Field brothers lay near the fire in front of the shelter. Lewis went to work. With Driard flashing the signs, he asked question after question. The Blackfeet said they were part of a large band that was one day's march away, near the foot of the mountains. They said there was a white man in their band. Another large band of their nation was hunting buffalo on its way to the mouth of Maria's River, where it would be in a few days. Lewis had no way to judge how much of this was meant to intimidate him, how much was true. If it was all true, it meant he was in the middle of the Blackfeet Nation, and that a Canadian trader was living with one band, which meant that they surely had many firearms. This group of 8 had 2 muskets. Lewis asked about the trading patterns of the Blackfeet. The boys informed him that they rode 6 days' easy march to reach a British post on the North Saskatchewan River, and that from the traders there, they obtain arms, ammunition, spirituous liquor, blankets, etc., in exchange for wolves and some beaver skins. This was unwelcome news. It reinforced Jefferson's worst fears. that agents of the Hudson's Bay Company and the Northwest Company were firmly entrenched on the northern plains and were rapidly extending their monopoly. But it gave Lewis an opportunity, which he characteristically seized. He told the Blackfeet in great detail how much better a deal they would get from the Americans once the Americans arrived on the high plains. He gave his peace speech. He said he had come from the rising sun and gone to where the sun set and had made peace between warring nations on both sides of the mountains. He said he had come to their country to invite the Blackfeet to join the American Empire. To all of this, as he understood them, they readily gave their assent. The braves were willing to talk the sign language as long as the smoking continued. They were extremely fond of tobacco, so Lewis plied them with the pipe until late at night. He let them know he had reinforcements in the area, a party of soldiers he would be meeting at the mouth of the Marias. He asked them to send two messengers to the nearby bands of Blackfeet to ask them to meet in 3 days at the mouth of the Marias River for a council about peace and trade. Perhaps a few chiefs would be willing to accompany the expedition to St. Louis and go on to visit their new father in Washington. Lewis concluded by asking the other 6 warriors to accompany him to the mouth of the Marias and promised them 10 horses and some tobacco if they would do these things. To this proposition they made no reply, Lewis recorded. Lewis had just made a serious political mistake. He had told these youngsters that he had organized their traditional enemies, the Nez Perce, the Shoshones, others, into an American-led alliance. Worse, he had indicated that the Americans intended to supply these enemies with rifles. The Blackfoot monopoly on firearms, based on their exclusive access to British suppliers, would be broken. As James Rhonda puts it, "The clash of empires had come to the Blackfeet. After more than 20 years of being the bully boys of the High Plains country, they were being challenged, as were their British friends." Lewis took the first watch. He wrote in his journal 2,000 words about the day. He covered it from start to finish with frequent interruptions to the narrative. In one paragraph, he compared the quality of water in Cutbank Creek and Two Medicine River. He made an astute ecological observation. Here in the eastern foothills of the Rocky Mountains was the only place that the 3 major cottonwood species grew together. Mainly, though, he described what had happened in an after-action report. At 11:30, he roused Reuben Field. He ordered Field to watch the movements of the Indians, and if one of them left camp, to awake the party, lest the Indians attempt to steal the detachment's horses. Then he lay down and immediately fell into a profound sleep.
"Damn you! Let go my gun!"
Driard's shout woke Lewis. It was a few minutes past first light. Lewis jumped up. He saw Driard scuffling with an Indian over a rifle. Lewis reached for his rifle but found it gone. He drew his horse pistol from its holster, looked up, and saw a second Indian running off with his rifle. Lewis ran at him and signaled to him when he turned that he would either lay down that rifle or get shot. As the Indian started to lay the rifle down, the Field brothers came running up in a state of the highest excitement. They aimed their rifles at the Indian, but before they could shoot, Lewis called out to stop them. The Indian was complying with his order. Driard came up, breathless and excited, asking permission to kill the Indian. Lewis forbade it. The party had recovered its rifles. The Indians were falling back. "What happened?" Lewis demanded. The explanation came in a rush of words. Joseph Field had carelessly laid down his rifle beside his sleeping brother at absolutely the worst possible moment, first light. A watching Indian had seized his opportunity to grab it and Reuben Field's rifle and run off. At the same instant, Driard said, he woke to see 2 Indians stealing his rifle and Lewis's. He chased the Indian, caught him, and took back his own rifle while Lewis was recovering his. The Field brothers, meanwhile, had dashed after the Indian carrying off their rifles. At 50 yards, they caught him and wrestled the rifles out of his hands. Reuben pulled his knife and plunged it into the young warrior's heart. The Indian, Field later said, drew but one breath, and the wind of his breath followed the knife, and he fell dead. But Lewis didn't have an opportunity to hear this report, because before the brothers finished, he noticed that the Indians were attempting to drive off his horses. Lewis called out orders.
Shoot those Indians if they try to steal our horses.
The Field brothers ran after the main party of Indians, who were driving four of their horses up the river. Lewis ran after two men who were driving off the remainder of the horses, including Lewis's. He sprinted for some 300 yards, at which point the Indians had reached the almost vertical bluff. They hid in a niche, a sort of alcove, in the bluff, driving the horses before them. Lewis, breathless, could pursue no farther. He shouted to them, as he had done several times already, that he would shoot them if they did not give back his horse. How much, if any, of this the Blackfeet understood cannot be said. What happened was that an Indian jumped behind a rock and said something to his companion. That man was armed with a British musket loader. He turned toward Lewis. Lewis brought his rifle to his shoulder, aimed, and fired. He shot the warrior through the belly. But the Blackfoot was not finished. He raised himself to his knee, took a quick aim, and fired at Lewis. "Being bareheaded," as Lewis commented, "I felt the wind of his bullet very distinctly." Since there were two Indians, one badly wounded, and they were armed and behind good shelters, and he wanted to get out of there, and his shot pouch was back at camp so he could not reload, Lewis decided to retreat. He made his way back to camp. There he told Driard to run and call the Field brothers back. They had enough horses. Driard tried, but they were too far away to hear. Lewis and Driard went to work saddling the horses. The Field brothers returned with four of the party's original horses. Lewis cast his eye over the herd and selected four Indian horses and three of his original bunch. As the men arranged saddles and the placement of the baggage on the pack horses, Lewis started burning the articles the Indians had left behind. Onto the fire went four shields, two bows, two quivers of arrows, sundry other articles. Only the musket the warriors had abandoned and the flag Lewis had given an Indian the previous evening escaped the fire. Those he took with him. Enraged at the Indian treachery, he left the medal he had given out at last night's campfire hanging around the neck of the dead Indian, that they might be informed who we were. But excited as he was, Lewis wasn't about to take a scalp, though he did cut off the amulets from the shields before throwing the shields on the fire and put them in his pack as a war souvenir. An after-action analysis of Lewis's first-ever Indian fight indicates that he and his men made many mistakes. The first and most important was Joseph Fields. It was inexcusable for the sentinel ever to lay down his rifle, immeasurably more so when in the presence of young Indians. One would have thought that, after 2 years in the wilderness, Lewis would have had that pounded into the head of every enlisted man. Lewis's failure to give orders that he and the other sleeping men should be woken at first light was a grave error. It was his clear duty and responsibility to be up, alert, and in full command at this most dangerous moment in the day. Once awake, he made a number of snap judgments, some of them showing restraint and good sense, others demonstrating his sometimes impetuous nature. His first order was exactly right. Get the rifles back. However dangerous it might be to chase an Indian carrying a rifle, those rifles were indispensable. His second order, forbidding the Field brothers and Driard to kill a retreating Indian who had laid down the stolen rifle, was also exactly right. Next to getting the rifles back and not losing the horses, avoiding bloodshed was clearly Lewis's first responsibility, and of course it was his commander-in-chief's direct order. At this time in the fight, Lewis did not yet know that Private Field had stabbed an Indian to death. When the Blackfeet started running off the horses, they were again attempting to steal what was indispensable to life on the plains. It is not so clear this time, however, that Lewis's immediate order to chase the Indians and get those horses back was necessary. There were 40 horses in the bottom, milling about in little groups. The thieves were never going to get them together into a herd and drive it off. While they were gathering horses, Lewis could have had his men doing the same. He later admitted that the Indian horse he took carried me very well, in short, much better than my own would have done, and leaves me with but little reason to complain of the robbery. But at the time, he didn't feel that way at all. He held the campsite, which contained all the equipment from both parties. The Indians were in full retreat. Lewis might have decided, "Let's get some horses for ourselves and let the Blackfeet go and get out of here." Instead, he ordered pursuit.
The Field brothers took off after the main party, which had crossed the river. Lewis was fortunate that the young men, with their adrenaline pumping, didn't kill one or two more warriors. His decision to leave the campsite himself to pursue two Indians leading away one of his horses and three or four of theirs was questionable. He left his command post and exposed himself to harm for what was not indispensable. But his blood was up. 300 yards is a long way to sprint when wearing tight leather leggings and carrying a rifle over the thieving Indians. Whether he had to shoot the warrior or not is unclear. Lewis's narrative of this fight is one of his best pieces of writing, with lots of drama and detail. One detail we don't get, however, what was the Indian doing just before Lewis shot him? Lewis does not say. If he was taking aim at Lewis, obviously Lewis had to fire. But if his musket wasn't at his shoulder, Lewis should not have fired. Another missing detail. Sometime before he fired his rifle, Lewis fired his pistol, but he does not say when. It seems most likely that he fired at the backs of the Indians as they were driving the horses toward the bluff. Another blunder, leaving the medal that they might be informed who we were, was an act of taunting and boasting that put into serious jeopardy the entire American Empire scheme Lewis was concocting. To turn the most powerful tribe on the upper Missouri into enemies of the United States was Lewis's biggest mistake. Lewis made no analysis of his actions. He was content to describe them with his characteristic honesty. He wasn't in the habit of justifying his decisions, although he usually explained his reasons for them. In this case, the only thing he felt needed explaining was why he didn't have his shot pouch with him when he fired. He was very defensive about this, almost as if he felt it was the only thing he had done wrong and he wanted to make sure everyone understood it couldn't have been helped, because he had no time to return to camp after recovering his rifle before he started chasing the Indians driving off the horses. One Indian boy killed, another with a presumably fatal wound. Four whites in the middle of a land with hundreds of Blackfoot warriors who would seek revenge the instant they heard the news. It was imperative that Lewis get himself and his men out of there, immediately. Off they rode up the bluff to a beautiful level plain and on toward the mouth of the Marias. Lewis knew he had to get there as soon as possible, in the hope of meeting with the canoes and party at that place, because he had no doubt the Blackfoot party would ride at top speed to the nearest band to report. He anticipated that, on hearing the news, a large party of warriors would immediately set out to kill any white men they could find. He feared there was a band of Blackfeet between him and the Marias, a band already headed toward the mouth of the river. If they discovered Sergeant Ordway's canoe party coming down from the falls, the soldiers would not be alert to their danger and might well be overwhelmed. The party retreated at a trot, covering about 8 miles per hour. Fortunately, recent rains had left little reservoirs scattered about, the prickly pears were few, and there were not many rocks and stones. They rode through the morning and midday, not stopping until 3 o'clock p.m., when they suffered our horses to graze and took some refreshment. They had covered 63 miles. After an hour and a half break, they mounted up and rode off to cover 17 more miles by dark. Then they killed a buffalo and ate, mounted up again and set off, this time at a walk. It was a night to remember. The tension was high, so too the concentration. The setting was magical. The plains were as flat as a bowling green. There were thunderclouds and lightning on every quarter but that from which the moon gave us light. Throughout the night, we continued to pass immense herds of buffalo. At 2 a.m. on July 28th, Lewis finally ordered a halt. The day had begun for the party at first light, about 3:30 a.m. on July 27th. The captain and his men had had an Indian fight to start the day, followed by a 100-mile ride. "We now turned out our horses," Lewis concluded his journal description of the day, "and laid ourselves down to rest in the plain very much fatigued, as may be readily conceived." Inexcusably and inexplicably, he did not post a sentinel. Lewis slept soundly, but only briefly. He woke at first light to find he was so stiff he could scarcely stand. He woke the men and told them to saddle up so they could get going. They too complained of stiffness and asked for more rest. I encouraged them by telling them that our own lives, as well as those of our friends and fellow travelers, depended on our exertions at this moment. That worked. They came alert, and the march was resumed. As they rode, Lewis exhorted, "I now told them that we must risk our lives on this occasion. I told them that it was my determination that if we were attacked in the plains, that the bridles of the horses should be tied together and we would stand and defend them, or sell our lives as dear as we could." That proved unnecessary. At 12 miles they came to the Missouri, rode down it another 8 miles, and heard the report of several rifles very distinctly. We quickly repaired to this joyful sound, and on arriving at the bank of the river, had the unspeakable satisfaction to see our canoes coming down. Lewis's party joined Sergeant Ordway's. The combined force consisted of 16 men. There were heartfelt greetings, but brief. Lewis explained the need for haste. The men quickly took the baggage from the horses and put it in the canoes, turned the horses loose, and set off. They went down the river to the mouth of the Marias, where they opened the caches from the previous summer. Some skins and furs were badly damaged, but the gunpowder, corn, flour, pork, and salt were in fairly good order. Back into the canoes, the white pirogue and 5 small canoes, and downstream as fast as possible. At 15 miles, Lewis reckoned that they had left the Blackfeet safely behind and made camp, prudently on the south bank across the river from any Blackfeet. That night there was a thunderstorm that lasted for hours. Lewis had no shelter of any kind. He just lay in the water all night. Lewis's exploration of the Marias was over. All in all, it had been a big mistake from the start. Many things went wrong, and nothing had been accomplished. Chapter 30. The Last Leg. July 29th to September 22nd, 1806. The job now was to reunite with Clark and his party and head on to the Mandan villages. In the morning, Lewis got an early start. The current being strong and the men anxious to get on, they plied their oars faithfully, and we went at the rate of about 7 miles an hour. Progress continued to be good over the next 5 days. Game was so plentiful that at one stop the men killed 29 deer. Lewis gave instructions to cook enough meat in the evening to last through the next day, so that no stops need be made for a noon meal. By this means we forward our journey at least 12 or 15 miles per day. By August 7th, they had reached the mouth of the Yellowstone. Clark wasn't there, but signs of an encampment indicated he had been a week earlier. Lewis found a piece of paper stuck on a pole. It had his name in the handwriting of Captain Clark. Only a fragment could be read, but from it Lewis learned that at this site game was scarce and mosquitoes were plentiful, so Clark had gone on and would be waiting for Lewis downstream. "I instantly re-embarked," Lewis wrote, "and descended the river in the hope of reaching Captain C.'s camp before night." He was so anxious to reunite that he wouldn't take the day or so necessary to fix the longitude of the junction, as he had promised to do the previous year when clouds had made observations impossible. He didn't catch Clark anyway. Clark had moved on. In the morning, Lewis followed. He didn't catch up that day or the next. On the morning of August 11th, seeing some elk on a thick willow bar, he put in and set out with Private Crouzat to replenish the meat supply. After Lewis killed one and Crouzat wounded one, they reloaded and plunged into the willow to pursue more elk. Lewis saw an elk some yards ahead. He raised his rifle to his shoulder, took aim, and was about to pull the trigger when he was hit in the buttocks by a rifle bullet. This severe blow spun him around. The bullet had hit him an inch below his hip joint on his left side, and passed through his buttocks to come out on the right side, leaving a 3-inch gash the width of the ball. No bone had been hit. The spent ball lodged in Lewis's leather breeches. Crouzat was nearsighted in his only good eye, and Lewis was wearing brown leather, so his first thought was that Crouzat had mistaken him for an elk. "Damn you!" Lewis shouted. "You have shot me!" There was no answer. Lewis called to Crouzat several times, still with no response. The shot had come from less than 40 yards away. If Crouzat couldn't hear him, it must not have been Crouzat who shot him. It must have been an Indian. In the thick willow, it was impossible to know if it was just one warrior or a war party. Lewis called to Crouzat to retreat, then retreated himself. He ran the first 100 paces until his wound forced him to slow down. When he got inside of the canoes, he called the men to their arms, to which they flew in an instant. Lewis informed them of what had happened, told them he intended to return and give battle and save Crusade, and ordered them to follow him. They did. But after 100 yards, their captain collapsed. His wounds had become so painful and his thigh was so stiff he could not press on. He told the men to continue without him. If they encountered a superior force, they should retreat, keeping up a fire. Lewis struggled back to the canoes. He laid his pistol on one side of him, his rifle on the other, and his air gun close at hand. He was determined to sell my life as dearly as possible. He was alone for about 20 minutes in a state of anxiety and suspense. Finally, the party returned with Crusat, who absolutely denied having shot the captain and swore he had never heard Lewis call to him. "I do not believe that the fellow did it intentionally," Lewis wrote, but neither did he believe Crusat's denials. He had the bullet in his hand. It was a 54 caliber from a U.S. Army Model 1803, not a weapon any Indian was likely to have. He conjectured that after shooting his captain in the ass, Crusat decided to deny everything. Sergeants Ordway and Gass, who were with the party when it met Crusat, wrote in their journals that, as far as they could tell, Crusat was entirely ignorant of having shot Lewis. Sergeant Gass helped Lewis get out of his clothes. Lewis dressed his wounds himself as best he could, introducing rolls of lint into the holes on each side of his buttocks, so that the wound would stay open and new tissue could grow from the inside out. The party proceeded downriver, Lewis lying on his stomach in the pirogue. At 4 o'clock p.m., they passed Clark's campsite of the previous night. There, one of the men found and brought to Lewis a note Clark had left on a post. Bad news. Clark wrote that the reason Lewis had found only a fragment of the letter at the Yellowstone was that Sergeant Pryor and his small party had passed that place after Clark left and before Lewis arrived, and Pryor had torn off part of the note. Pryor and his 3 men were traveling in bull boats, which they had made after losing all their horses to Indian thieves. Losing the horses wasn't so bad, especially since Pryor had been resourceful enough to build bull boats and rejoin Clark, but it was a serious blow in that Pryor had not been able to deliver to Mr. Heaney of the Northwest Company the letter asking his help in getting some Sioux chiefs to come to Washington. Heaney had been Lewis's only hope for pacifying the Sioux and making them a part of the American system. Lewis's entire Indian policy was coming apart. He had hostile Blackfeet behind him and hostile Sioux in front of him. Between them, they could block the entire middle section of the Missouri River to traders. Along with the bad news, Lewis's wounds grew so painful that when the party made camp, he found he could not bear to be moved. He had a poultice of Peruvian bark applied to the wounds and spent the night stretched out on his belly on board the pirogue. He had a high fever and a restless night. In the morning, he was stiff and sore, but the fever had receded, probably thanks to the Peruvian bark, a standard remedy for fevers with the captains. The pain remained. The party set out. At 8 o'clock a.m., it encountered 2 white men coming upriver. They were Joseph Dixon of Illinois and Forrest Hancock of Boone Settlement in Missouri, fur trappers out on their own. They had started in August 1804, spent the winter in Iowa, been robbed by Indians who also wounded Hancock, but were nevertheless proceeding upriver to get to the Yellowstone and trap beaver. In other words, the Lewis and Clark expedition had been only 3 months ahead of private trappers in exploring the Louisiana Purchase. Dixon and Hancock were the cutting edge of what might be called the fur rush. It could be taken for granted that there would be many others coming close behind them. However much Jefferson might want to reserve Upper Louisiana for displaced Indians from east of the Mississippi, no power on earth, and certainly no laws written in Washington, could stop the American frontiersmen. They were lured up the Missouri River by a spirit of adventure, by a cockiness and bravado that were not entirely without foundation, by a love of the wilderness, and by greed. Powerful motives in young men, the kind that can't be denied. Lewis was eager to help establish an American presence in Upper Louisiana. He gave Dixon and Hancock information on what lay ahead of them, provided them with some sketch maps, and told them where they could find beaver in abundance. He also gave them a file and some lead and powder. The party set out again. At 1 o'clock p.m., it overtook Captain Clark and his party. The joy of reunion was a bit dampened by Lewis's condition. Informed that his friend had been wounded, Clark dashed to his pirogue. He was much alarmed to see Lewis lying on his belly, but Lewis raised his head to assure him that the wound was slight and would be healed in 3 or 4 weeks. "This information relieved me very much," Clark wrote. News was exchanged. The first was the best. Everyone was present, and, except for Lewis, in good health. Clark described the passage through today's Bozeman Pass to the Yellowstone, where Sacagawea was his guide. A party of Crows had stolen 24 of his 50 horses. He built 2 dugout canoes, each 28 feet long, and lashed them together for stability. His trip down the river was comparatively uneventful. It had an important payoff in the form of Clark's map. Late in the afternoon, Dixon and Hancock came into camp. For some unknown reason, they had decided to put off their trip to the Yellowstone for a while and join the party for the 2-day trip to the Mandan villages. That evening, Captain Clark washed Captain Lewis's wounds, which remained sore. For sure, he didn't wash them in water that had been boiled first. It was just plain Missouri River water. Lewis was lucky his wounds did not become infected. When Clark finished, Lewis wrote in his journal. After describing the day, he declared that, "As writing in my present situation is extremely painful to me, I shall desist until I recover and leave to my friend Captain C. the continuation of our journal." That was his last entry in the journals of Lewis and Clark. Fittingly, he did not end it right there, but felt compelled to go on to write one last botanical description. "I must notice a singular cherry," he wrote. It was the pin or bird cherry. Despite his pain and his situation, he gave it a complete going over. He measured and examined and described. For example, "The leaf is petiolate, oval, acutely pointed at its apex, from 1 1/4 to 1 1/2 inches in length, and from 1/2 to 3/4 of an inch in width, finely or minutely serrate, pale green and free from pubescence." In the morning, the reunited expedition set off. 2 days later, on August 14th, the Mandan villages came into view. "Those people were extremely pleased to see us," Clark reported. There were reunions with such old friends as the Mandan chiefs Black Cat and Shihiki, Big White, and the Hidatsa Liborna, One Eye, and others. Hugs and small presents and a smoking ceremony marked the occasion. Then there were councils with René Jassom serving as translator. How much of a role Lewis played is unclear, but apparently it was a minor one. He had fainted that day when Clark was changing his dressing. The news from the chiefs was all bad. The Arikaras and the Mandans had been fighting. The Hidatsas had sent a war party into the Rockies and killed some Shoshones, possibly from Kamiyawate's band. The Sioux had raided the Mandans, and the Mandans were divided by internal quarrels. This was dreadful. The American peace policy had failed within days of the departure of Lewis and Clark. The whole middle and upper Missouri River was at war. It was as if Lewis and Clark had never come, never made promises, never extracted pledges to be good. Making matters worse, the chiefs turned down Clark's invitation to come to Washington. Black Cat said he wished to visit the United States and meet his great father, but he was afraid of the Sioux below and would not go. Clark promised protection and lots of presents. He said if the chiefs would come to Washington, an American trading post would be built among the Mandans much sooner than otherwise. The chiefs still said no. Eventually, after much pleading from Jassom, who had his interpreter's fee at stake, Big White agreed to accompany the expedition to St. Louis and go on to Washington, if the captains would take his wife and son, Jassom, and Jassom's Indian wife and 2 sons. This was dangerously overloading the canoes, but the captains were desperate to bring chiefs to Washington, so Clark reluctantly agreed. When Big White and his entourage walked through the village past his people on the way to the canoes, Clark noticed that many of them cried out aloud. Few expected to see him return. On August 17th, just before departing, Clark settled with Charbonneau. He received $500.33 1/3 cents for his horse, his teepee, and his services. Sacagawea got nothing. The Charbonneaus stayed with the Mandans. Another member of the expedition left the party that day. Dixon and Hancock had asked Private John Coulter to join them in their Yellowstone venture. He accepted, subject to the captain's approval. They gave it on the condition that no other man ask for a similar change in the conditions of his enlistment. Coulter's enlistment would not expire until October 10, 1806. None did, and when the expedition set off downstream, Coulter turned back upstream, back to the wilderness, back to the mountains, on his way into the history books as America's first mountain man and the discoverer of Yellowstone National Park. Whether the men watched him depart, whether they thought, "What a fool," or felt envy, Clark did not record. But his conditional approval of Coulter's request indicates that Clark thought that at least some others might well be tempted to return to the Yellowstone country. As the expedition began the final run for St. Louis, Captain Lewis was still on his belly. His wounds were healing, but still so painful that he could not walk. On the fourth day out, the Americans encountered three French trappers headed for the Yellowstone country. The news they had was another blow to Lewis's and Clark's Indian policy. The Arikara chief, who in April 1805 had accompanied Corporal Worthington to St. Louis and then went on to Washington, had died. The Arikaras did not yet know this. That afternoon, the expedition reached the Arikara village. There was a council. Whether Lewis attended is not known. Clark asked the chiefs to send a delegation to Washington. Several said they were eager to see their great father, but wished to see the chief who went down last summer return first. On August 22nd, Clark wrote a medical report. "I am happy to have it in my power to say that my worthy friend Captain Lewis is recovering fast. He walked a little today for the first time. I have discontinued the tent lint in the hole the ball came out." The next day, the report read, "My friend Captain Lewis is recovering fast. The hole in his thigh where the ball passed out is closed and appears to be nearly well. The one where the ball entered discharges very well."